Well, I will meet you guys. I'm Holly Allen. I now teach at Lipscomb University. Before that, I taught at John Brown University in Northwest Arkansas. I taught before that at Biola and Talbot in California. I taught in the education department there in educational psychology and reading disability, things like that. And before that, I taught at Abilene Christian for about 10 years in the education department. My field was education for about 25 years, and then I had kind of a change in my life, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. I tend not to talk very loud. If you feel like you need to move up, feel free. This would be a good chance for you to do that. I can yell, but I forget, and I quit yelling about halfway through. So you might want to come up where you can hear. I always like to meet my audience, and we're a little bit too big to do that, but sometimes I like to go around and meet you. I know a few of you, so it's always good to see familiar faces. It's a blessing to be here with you. Let's pray. Our good Father, I thank you for these men and women whom you called into your ministry and your service. We are listening today, our ears attuned to what you would have us hear, and for me, what you would have me say. I ask that whatever I say, that the people here who've come will hear what you want them to hear today, that will bless them in their work, in the ministry, in the good things that you've given them to do with the people you've blessed them with to serve. We thank you for your presence among us through Christ. Amen. Come on in. Well, this is my heart. This is where I've spent the last about 20 years. It's on bringing the generations together. This work on the impact of intergenerational experiences began for me about 20 years ago. I was working, my husband and I, Leonard and I, were working with a new church plant in Abilene. We were meeting in the Civic Center downtown. It's not a huge city, but there still was somewhat of an inner city there. We started with three or four families, a few singles, a bunch of college students, but we grew very, very fast. So we started out in a very small room at the Civic Center downtown. We were renting, but we kept growing, and they kept putting us in different venues. And each Sunday was kind of different because sometimes the venue we were used to, which maybe would be a room like this, they would say, oh, I'm sorry, there's an annual event that always takes place in this room on this Sunday. So they would put us somewhere else. And as we were there over a period of years, we began to realize there were several annual events that we had to work around. And I always like to start with this because it was so funny. One Sunday that happened every year was called Fish Tank Sunday. And they brought in a huge fish tank and a bunch of fish, and you could bring your kid there and fish. And toward the end of our time, we were in the largest venue, and that's where they put the fish tank, up on the stage. And so we were in the main 1,000-seat auditorium, and there would be this huge fish tank up there, and there'd be the people leading singing in front of that, and right behind them was a fish tank, and the smell was a little overwhelming. So that was Fish Tank Sunday. Then there was Bikini Sunday, and that was in September every year when the car dealers in town would bring in their new models, and at that time it was still politically okay to ask Miss Texas and all the other Miss Whatevers to come in and sit on the cars in their bikinis. And literally at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning when we let out, there they would be, right in the open atrium air, we would walk out. And the bevy of beauties would be sitting on the cars. So we call that Bikini Sunday. And then, but the most dissonant, come on in, the most, you might want to come on up. I tend not to talk very loud. I mean to, and people keep going, you're not talking loud enough. So come on up, make yourself at home up here. I'm talking about the years that we were part of a church plant in downtown Abilene. We were meeting in the Civic Center, and every Sunday, well, a lot of Sundays we were in the same venue, but sometimes we had to move around, and sometimes we had to move depending on what Sunday it was, because there were annual events that took place, and they had to have certain venues. Well, the third one that was the most dissonant for me, there was the marquee that said, Abilene Mission Church, 10 o'clock. Gun and knife show, 9:30 to 6. And so there we were sharing the venue with the gun and knife show. And it just always felt really strange to me. But it was always very interesting to be working where all kinds of people were coming in at all times. We did have homeless people who would wander in, people who were a little high that week, either on drugs or alcohol. The church itself attracted very, very broken people. And it made our work rich and good as people begin, when they're at the bottom. I mean, God is so inviting. And to join Him in the work that He was doing was a life-changing 4 years for me. We had our down and out and our up and out. And our down and out, you know who they are. The up and out, those are the people who've had their millions and been bankrupt or had the wonderful family and lost everything because of behaviors. We had suicidal people. We had lots of broken families, lots of people going through divorce. About 20 to 25 young men struggling with same-sex attraction, and several young women. Probably our biggest challenge at the time. But all these were in great need of a radical body of believers who would love them and receive them and extend grace to them. And we found ourselves among them and needing grace, as did everyone. But one unique aspect of this community was that we were intentionally intergenerational. We met every Sunday night in intergenerational small groups. Now, we started with one group. We had 25 people. In 4 years, we moved to about 700 or 800 people, 600, 700, 800, depending on the Sunday. But we had about 600 people in small groups. Almost everyone was in a small group. We had 25, I think we got 27 small groups by the end of our time there. And we met every week, and we met on Sunday evenings on this weekly basis. And so every week I participated in small, intimate settings, and where children, teens, college students, graduate students, young families, middle adults and older adults. We didn't have very many older adults. We needed more. But we all sang together, prayed, listened, laughed, shared, played, cried, and hoped together. And ate. We blessed one another. Changed my life. Changed my understanding of children and my understanding of Christian spiritual formation for children and adults. My background, as I just said earlier, was in education. So I'd gotten all the developmental psychology, all the cognitive psychology, psychosocial development, all that stuff. And I had an understanding of where children were supposed to be in teens. And these intergenerational small groups didn't seem to play out what I had been learning in my educational psychology. Children began, and our teens began, praying and ministering with and for each other and for their parents and for other adults. But it wasn't just the children. We were all growing each other up. And a question, this question just rose. We'd been there, I see, 93, 94, probably around 95. And so one key question just rose in me. At the time, I'm not sure I would have said God brought this question to mind, but He did. This was my question. What is it about intergenerational settings that uniquely and especially fosters spiritual growth and development? I didn't know what it was, but I was seeing that and experiencing that every week. It drove my doctoral work. I began planning to do that. And the work that I do now has grown out of those life-changing intergenerational small groups, and it's the work that I believe God's called me to in this season in my life. Usually people say, what happened in those small groups? And so I will tell you. Every week we did four things. First thing we did was an icebreaker. And, you know, an icebreaker doesn't seem very spiritual, but things were going on, even in the icebreakers. Usually the questions were pretty ordinary, like, what did you, your family do for the 4th of July, or what did you do for the 4th of July? I remember one icebreaker was, what are you afraid of? And, you know, I started it by saying I'm afraid of dogs. I was bitten by a dog when I was 3, and I'm afraid of dogs. And, I mean, nothing real spiritual there. A woman said, I'm afraid of gaining too much weight in my pregnancy. Then a young man said, I'm afraid I'm going to die young like my father did. There was a graduate student who said, I'm afraid I'm not going to finish my thesis. There was a little fourth grade boy right by him who said, I'm afraid I'm not going to graduate. I'm not going to graduate. I'm not going to finish fourth grade. I'm going to fail fourth grade, which was just as important to him as the thesis was to the graduate student. Then it was Jasmine's turn. She was a young woman, had two little boys, had not been married. They were by different fathers, and she had a current boyfriend who was in prison. And she said, I'm afraid Ben is not going to get his parole. And then next to her was her little boy, one of her little boys, Jeremy. And he said, he just started crying. He put his hand on his His head on his arm, and he said, "I'm afraid of the dark. I have nightmares." He started crying, and one of the dads, there was no dad in his home, one of the dads in the group came over immediately and began to pray for him. He prayed for him right then. One of the sixth grade girls said, "I used to have nightmares, and I've been praying about that, and God's been taking them away." But the most special moment was a girl who was about 25, and she just looked up with this surprised look on her face, and she said, "I was reading in the Psalms this morning. I have a verse for you." She was a brand new Christian. She'd been baptized 3 weeks before then, and she said, "Let me look it up." And she found it, Psalm 4, verse 8. She said, "I go to sleep in peace. Lord, you keep me safe." It was her first time to minister to someone else. Now, this was the icebreaker. It didn't normally happen like this. But it did happen occasionally, that even in the icebreaker, moments of ministry happened, cross-generational ministry. But even when that didn't happen during the icebreaker, what cumulatively happened is that we came to know each other by name. Because you would always say, "My name is Holly and I'm afraid of dogs," or whatever it is. You'd say your first name. If we just knew each other's name, this would be a good place to start. We're not going to be able to bless one another very much if we don't know each other by name. So we came to know the children by name, and they knew us as well. So, and we learned some trivial things about each other. But we entered each other's lives. The funny parts, the sad parts, the hopeful parts, the fearful parts. And we began to see each other, from this big to the oldest, as whole, multidimensional, growing people, all called by God into a spiritual journey, these spiritual journeys that we were sharing. It was a marvelous thing. If that's all we had done as a church, it would have been a wonderful journey. There were other things going on, wonderful worship times and that sort of thing, but good things were happening in the small group. We also prayed every week for every family unit. Now, a family unit didn't have to be mom, dad, and the kids. We had lots of single parents. We had one widow that I know of. We didn't have many older people, and she was a fairly young widow. She was in her 50s. We had one wonderful, really older couple. Then we had, lots of 40s and 50s, or some 40s and 50s, lots of young families, but lots of graduate students, lots of college students, lots of singles, lots of teens coming without any other family. So we had lots of, singles in our groups, but they were a family unit. So every week we prayed for everybody. And it didn't have to be the hardest things. Our young men who were struggling with homosexuality, that's not when we prayed for that. That was in other settings. But every week, you'd say, it's what we're dealing with. And sometimes we'd have sibling stuff to talk about. We would have, new babies that were coming, new pregnancies we would pray for. Any transition, going into first grade, leaving high school, going off to college, new jobs, loss of jobs. Just pray for all those good things, and sometimes the hard things. I do remember a young couple in their 30s. They'd both been married before. She brought two little girls to this blended marriage, and when she got pregnant in that marriage, it was a time of rejoicing in our group, and we were really delighted for them, and we began praying over that baby. But she lost it at 3 months. It was an early miscarriage, and it was really devastating for our children in our group, but we talked about it. It wasn't something that happened somewhere that nobody ever talked about. We'd been praying for this little baby. And my daughter was 8 at the time. And she was very concerned. What happened to that baby? Where is that baby? Is that baby, with God? Or was it just a nothing? So we had lots of good questions. And the other children did too. But at a time of grieving, as a small group. And I remember the worship time after that was not just that night, but for weeks to come was time of lament. But she got pregnant again, and we began praying for that baby. And she let her two little girls and my little girl put their hands on her growing belly. And, if you were the last kid in the family, you don't get to do that with your mama. And so, I didn't know till I was pregnant that it's hard. I thought it would be soft and gushy, but it's hard. And my little girl was like, oh, it's like really hard. And she got to feel the baby kick, and it was terribly important. Those girls got to experience very experientially, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And that baby came to fruition. His name is Jackson. I still know this family. And it was a delightful and wonderful time for us to experience as a group together, and very spiritual as we saw God bring to fruition this wonderful fruit growing in her. But all transitions were important. I remember especially praying for our kids going into middle school. No child should enter middle school without lots and lots of prayer, you know. And we would pray over those kids. The children very soon, and the teens were very willing to pray for someone. We would gather and they would pray for and lay their hands on. It usually took about 6 months for the children to be willing to ask for prayer specifically, and because they knew people would pray for them and gather around. And so you have to feel safe. And it took them sometimes a little while. Every spring, those achievement tests that, you know, they give at school, there were always children who were just terrified. I didn't realize that some children are terrified of those. And so we would always pray over those children. Very important. Something happened about this time that really showed me what was happening in all of us. I was starting my graduate work. I needed some leveling work to go off and do doctoral work. So I was taking James Thompson's New Testament theology. He was really known as a very difficult graduate teacher. And I may have been the only woman in the class. There were about 30 men. And so I wanted to do well. And the first test, I stayed up until midnight studying, and then I got up about 5:30, and my son, who was about 13 at the time, he was usually the first riser in our house, and he got up about 6:30, and he found me studying. He says, what's up? I said, I'm studying for this test. I've forgotten everything that I read about last night. I'm going to do terribly. And I thought he would say something like, do you want me to go make you some tea, or do you want me to call words? But you know, he said, do you want me to pray for you? Really important moment in our relationship. He sat right down beside me on that blue couch and he prayed for me. He's 31 now, and we talk about that once in a while. It was a really important bonding time. He was learning that the first thing you do is pray. And it's not because he heard a sermon on it or because someone taught him that in class. He experienced that. But that's what you do. Lovely moment for us. And every week, we worshiped together. And worship, of course, can be your whole life before God. But I meant we sang every week. And then we were Church of Christ. We were a cappella. So we didn't have to worry about, can anyone play anything this week? But every week, a child and an adult, or a teen and a college student, any two people we would kind of assign it the week before, would choose the songs. And during the week, we'd say, okay, who's going to do it next week? And two people would volunteer. It could be a kid and a parent. But two people, and some children were very, very serious about this. They had their list, you know, already made up, and others were a little more casual. But I did notice that the children never wanted to sing Father Abraham or any other kid's song. They sang the real songs. They wanted to sing the real praise songs and songs that we sang when we worshiped on Sunday morning. Sometimes our praise time lasted a few minutes, sometimes up to a half an hour. Kind of depended on how many songs were chosen, the spirit of the group, the response to the Sunday morning experiences, or the needs of the evening as we had prayed. Sometimes the praise turned into a lament. We did have a few written lament songs because there aren't many in our hymnology. But we had written some. And the woman who lost her baby sometime before had written two that we learned as a church. But it wasn't set. It wasn't like 5 minutes or 20 minutes. It was kind of as the evening flowed. But everyone participated. One evening, I remember a little kindergartner named Justin. We'd been singing Jesus, Lamb of God. And after we finished, she said, can we sing it again? Have you ever been somewhere where you wanted to sing it again? But you know, you never can just say, hey, let's sing it again. You can't do that. But he felt free enough to do that. And of course, we did. And it was just all the sweeter knowing he wanted to sing it again. Another time, whoever was supposed to choose the songs hadn't done so. So that night we said, okay, what would you like to sing? Listen, what would you like to sing? And so we just asked people. And it came to a 12-year-old boy who ordinarily didn't participate very much. He seemed a little not very engaged often, but it came to him, and I figured he'd say, I don't have a song. But he said, I want to sing While You Sing Over Me. Now, this is a Dennis Jernigan song from 20 years ago, and it's a song about someone who feels very lonely, in great need of love and care and cherishing. What was going on there? We begin to see into our spiritual lives one of the other. Parents into children, adults into children and teens into their parents and other adults. When you worship in small, intimate settings, it's different than when you worship in a large group, when you sing together. So we begin to reveal our inner spiritual lives to our children and theirs to us. It's a good thing. And again, because of our heritage, we had the Lord's Supper every week. And we did take it in our small groups. We received some criticism for that. But almost everyone in our church was part of it. We had about 600 people participating in our small groups. We had about 700 or maybe 800 on Sunday morning, but we had about 100 to 200 visitors every week. So nearly everyone was part of a small group. And we loved taking Lord's Supper in these small and intimate settings. It can become a rote ceremony if you do it in a large group, but every week, and we had committees that set this up, they'd come up with four or five different small group ways to do this, and then we'd change the committee every two or three months so they'd have fresh ideas. One week, two fathers read from Genesis 22, where God asked Abraham to sacrifice his son, Isaac. And the father who read Abraham's part described later what it may have felt like as Abraham. And then the father who read God's part in that passage described how God perhaps felt when he sacrificed his son. One week, each person present said what was the moment of crucifixion that they thought was probably the worst moment for Jesus. Another week, the worst moment for God. One week I brought this wonderful painting or picture I have of Michelangelo's most famous Pietà. That's the one of Mary holding Jesus at the foot of the cross. Now, as far as we know, that didn't happen just like that, but it's still a wonderful sculpture that's in St. Peter's in Rome. And we talked about Mary. We do know she stood at the foot of the cross. And it was amazing. We kind of ignored Mary, you know. We may not know that, but we sort of have ignored Mary generally. I don't know exactly why. But we had a wonderful conversation of what it was like for her. You know, she knew in her very body that he was the Son of God. She knew more than Peter or John or anybody. She knew good and well she was a virgin when she had that baby. It had to be God. How could he be dead? I mean, it must have been completely crazy making for her. She knew. So how could he die? That was one of those stunning moments. Our kids got that. They got it. Our teens were overwhelmed seeing that picture and her depth of loss. I mean, how are you, many of you are familiar with what I'm talking about? She's holding him and her left hand is just out with this sense of, how could this be? Deep insight. I mean, the apostles were just blown away. They just thought it was ridiculous. They'd put their 3 years of life into this man, and obviously he wasn't who he said he was, but Mary knew he was. So that deepness, that insight, we all experienced at a different level. Another week that I remember really well, we reenacted the Last Supper. And so we did the cups and all. But we had done the Passover, a Messianic Passover, a few weeks before that. And the clicks, clicks, clicks. I remember this. The apostles, they were listening to this. And then somebody said, they didn't even know he was talking about himself. Take this. This is my body. This is my blood. They didn't get it. Of course they didn't get it. He hadn't died yet. And then some kids said, but they did the next year. And then some other... And some other kids said, well, I didn't even do it the next year, because then there were Christians. And somebody else said, no, they kept doing it. The Jews kept doing it for years. And this great conversation, but that insight, they did the next year. He was the Lamb. Oh, just this ding, 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 ding. It was just wonderful. Different ways to take the Lord's Supper, and all the different ways, multiplicities of ways of thinking about it. Another week, some of the adults told the first time they took communion. And for several, it was the minute they were baptized. You know, their hair was wet, and they came out, and they saved communion until after the baptism so they could participate. Others, it was at a summer camp. But just different ways of making this very real. Wonderful, wonderful. But you see the kinds of things that happened in these small groups, how we began to enter each other's spiritual stories. It was really wonderful. One of the added benefits of doing the Lord's Supper together in this setting was that families became more comfortable talking about spiritual things at home. And one of the big things we find in research is that families don't know how to talk about what God is doing in them with their families. They go to church, they do church things, they're all believers, and they get home and it's like, how was church? Good. What'd you study in class? Oh, wasn't that a good sermon? Done. But instead of going into, yeah, I never thought about how Mary felt. Man, that must have been really crazy. But those kinds of conversations can continue in the family. It becomes less awkward. And again, that way we enter each other's stories better. So that answers the question, what happened in those small groups that made me begin to think, maybe we should be together in our generations more intentionally and more often. But I still hadn't answered my main question, which is, what is it about intergenerational settings? You caught glimpses, but I wanted a theory. Well, I have five questions we're going to talk about today. And I'm going to ask you, I think, if I remember, at the beginning of each question, will you just give me a little feedback? And so the first question is, what is the problem? What is the key problem? When I talk about intergenerational Christian formation, what's a problem in our society that makes it a problem? What's happening among us and what's been going on for 100 years? That makes this almost not possible.
Technology.
Oh, huge. It separates us, doesn't it? That's been happening for 10 or 20 years. It separates us in lots of ways. What are the things that have been happening as a general society that makes intergenerational experiences just absent?
We live apart.
We live apart. That's one of the key things. We've been dividing by generations for 100 years, and literally, you know, I don't live near my grandchildren even, and it makes me sad. We live in nuclear families, so we don't have cross-generational experiences, even in our extended families. We don't do anything together much as generations. I was at a baseball game not long ago, and I looked around. There were lots of generations there, but we weren't interacting with each other. We were watching the game. We weren't doing anything together. Can you think of any place in our society where the generations are really interacting regularly? Somebody said Boy Scouts once that when they do the Eagle thing and all that, that the families of the boys come together. And there's probably a little more there, the dads and the boys, so that the boys get to know some of the other dads. And the dads get to know other boys besides their own. I thought that was a good example. And it's not all the generations, but it's two generations, and you're knowing somebody else's family besides your own, and that they're knowing the kids. That was a good example. Can you think of another one? I just can't think of one.
Once a year, Thanksgiving.
Okay, yeah, your literal family gets together, and that's fabulous. Although, Carol Powell wrote recently, she said, in her family growing up, there were 18 cousins, and they got their own table. And in fact, they were actually in the basement. And she said, although all the family was together, what we experienced, the loudest burping and all the stuff that the kids did down there, was an entirely different experience than whatever was going on with the adults. And she said, you know, some of us wanted to, she's at 18, she was still at the kids' table. She was like, can I be an adult yet? So sometimes, though, we may be in the same building even, we're having different experiences. But a lot of times that is a good place for all the families, all the generations to come together within a family. And that does bring up the point that when I'm talking about intergenerational Christian formation, although I'm talking about our extended and blood family, I am talking about the body of Christ. I'm mainly talking about all the generations in the body of Christ. But we in our culture, our literal family generations are separated most of the time, I'm sad to say. So we've kind of answered that problem. And basically, the problem is that the generations are really separate for almost everything we do. Churches were the only place that all the generations came together on a regular basis until... When did that start happening, that we started separating out intentionally? Some of you are old enough. 70s. I was part of it. I'm guilty. I was like, oh, we need children's church. We got to get those kids out. Let them learn on their own. You know, that kind of thing. I did it. I mean, I was there. It was Mentor Lane Church of Christ. It was 80s for me. But I was like, oh, we need to do puppets or whatever. I was really promoting that from my educational background. And we'll talk about that in a minute. So why? Why have faith communities separated? Why did we start doing this? What was going on? So you give me some reasons. I have at least 10, so anything you say, I'm sure I've got something to say about. So what do you think, from your perspective? Some of you are old enough to remember the 70s and 80s. What were some of the things that were going on?
Well, teaching, you know, youth and middle schoolers is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kind of said, we need somebody who's really good at doing that and can connect with them.
Uh-huh.
And so we'll just kind of pass them off to this person. And then we adults can have better conversations amongst ourselves.
I do think that was a good way to say it. You know, it sounds like we wanted to have our own time, but I do think it was out of a good heart. We did think they would benefit by having their own time with special and gifted teachers. We were very concerned. It did start with youth, by the way. It started with youth, not children. That youth had unique, mostly psychosocial or social or doubt issues that needed, we thought, to be addressed in a unique setting. And there are some people who are really gifted, and some of us are really not. And so I think it was a good heart that said, I think they'll benefit. Let's do this for their sake. And another blessing for us was, hey, we can have a real conversation here. So it was a kind of a side benefit, we thought. But mainly, I think it was for them. That was one. And it did start with youth. That's at least one reason. I'd say there are 9 more good reasons. So what else are you thinking? What else was going on?
One church that we were a part of, there was a real lack of tolerance for kids acting up.
Yeah.
In fact, the culture there was you did not bring your small children to the worship. So there were children's church. And, you know.
I took that picture.
Now, you know, there was, I don't want to paint that. It was a great-hearted church, but
sure.
That was just
yeah.
Part of the culture there.
Yeah, and it still is.
You're a pin drop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it really, worship should be very solemn, very serious, and we needed silence in order to be able to do it well. And so children need to be elsewhere. That actually was a piece of this, especially for some groups. Less so in general for Churches of Christ, but some of the more liturgical churches, it was just very improper to have children there. Like, I took a child to a wedding one time at an Episcopal church. Oh my goodness. I felt like I was naked. I didn't realize it was just, you're not supposed to do that. But I didn't have any option. Anyway, at some particular churches, really, children are just not welcome. And it's still true in some settings. And I, like I said, I took that picture. I was very sad. I just was very upset, actually. I thought, not very hard, good heart on my part. What else? Yeah.
I think there was an evangelism techniques when we really started reaching out with like bus ministries and those kind of things
to
bring
yeah.
people in. So there were a lot of young people coming that were coming with families.
That's right.
And it was like, well, we need something special that we're available in the next year.
I think that's right. That was a very unique, special thing, but it really may have called for that until they could at least learn how to be with us. That was probably a really good thing for a while. It became a whole long trajectory, but I do think that was one thing that drove this, especially children's church. And that would be one of my main reasons. I feel, from my cognitive developmental psychology idea, I was realizing, children learn differently than adults. They need all the 5 senses. They need movement. I thought, we should take everything I'm learning in my education world, and we should just transfer it over here. And so they need to have this bright, fun, shiny Sesame Street version of learning. It seemed well-grounded to me at the time. What I didn't realize is that cognitive or thinking development is not the same as spiritual development. Those are not the same constructs. Now, if our only goal is to teach them information, by all means, let's just go teach them information in the ways that they can learn. They're not going to actually learn from the adult sermon very well. They'll pick up some things. If you're only concerned about information, yes, we should go do that. But is that our primary concern? It's not our primary concern. We do want them, by the way, to learn the books of the Bible and the chronology of Scripture, by all means. And I think there's still a very important place for Sunday school, age-graded Sunday school. I think there are very important things for them to learn. But I think there need to be very important and intentional times when we're all together doing and being who we are as the body of Christ, because they're picking up on so much more. I was with my sisters this week. We're rarely together, and so we intended to come together. I was in Florida, and one of my sisters lives there. The other flew in from where she lives. And we were talking about childhood memories. And I said, don't you remember in Hickory Ridge, Arkansas, when we were little bitty girls, on Wednesday nights, once a month, they would have a prayer service. And everybody stayed. Everybody stayed. And I would say the building was about this size. It was pews, but it was about this big. And so there were about 8 or 10 pews on each side. And we would just sit there for an hour while the men prayed. And so the men, you would pray, and then you would pray, and then you would pray, and then you would pray. And the children, I was just bored to tears. I would swing my feet. I counted all these tiles. No, tiles are here. I counted all the tiles back that way and all the tiles across. I was too little to multiply. But I counted them. And, I knew how many tiles there were. We had light fixtures that were like this, and I couldn't figure out if there were two or one, and I would just look and look, and then I'd get bored and I'd hang my head over the pews and try to match shoes and people. But you know what? They prayed, and I knew it. Those men and the rest of us sat there and we prayed for an hour on Wednesday night. And 50-something years later, I still remember. We would never put our children through that, would we? We would find something important for them to do somewhere else. But do you see what I got? That deep sense. That Hickory Ridge Church is still thriving today. And I think it's partly because they were a praying church. So, what did I get? Oh yeah, I counted tiles. But children are very able to absorb many things around them. You've ever heard that little kid right in the middle of a sermon look up and go, he knows that story too. I mean, you think they're not paying any attention. And they remember. He's telling a story they already know. And goodness sakes, that preacher knows it too. Who would have thought? So they're picking up on not only what is being said, but what we're doing. They're very keenly aware of our faces, our body language, what we're absorbing. If we're not paying attention, a lot is going on. And they're very aware of what's in the building. We were sort of a stark, we were the Zwingliites who kind of took down everything in the building. Now I know this room's real busy, but our buildings were very plain. And so I counted ceiling tiles and light fixture things. Had there been the fabulous banners that we have today, I would have stared at those banners and they would be deeply embedded in me now. But our children in our buildings, as whatever else is going on, they're taking in those stained glass windows or whatever is there. That's going inside them. And it's a good thing. Good, rich things are happening in them. They put their own meanings on them, by the way. And sometime in their life, they will start asking questions. And they may have already put together that banner in a way that it speaks to them, and it may not have been in any way what was intended. But they gleaned out of it what God was placing in them. I love that. So we talked about things in society. I talked about developmental psychology. I think that was a driving force, that we did it for the right reason. We were very interested in making sure children, in particular, got what they needed. Youth, I think we were very aware that they just have special and unique needs that need to be dealt with in a setting that's somewhat different, perhaps, than adults. But I also think that elders in particular have been very aware that our emerging adults, our young adults, our middle adults, and our older adults are very different stages of life. And the questions that, especially, and you notice this today, our emerging adults, they're facing a very different world than we did when we were 20-something. Very sexually charged world. But there are a lot of common things, too. They're entering the workforce. They're choosing a mate. Those are very different life issues than boomers are facing, which is retirement's coming up soon, and or seniors who are facing assisted care places. Those are such different needs. We think, well, maybe we need a 39ers class. Maybe we need an emerging adult class. And there's nothing wrong with that, but if that's all we do, we're missing out on each other. And especially our emerging adults are missing out on what we've learned that we can pass on to them. They need places to be heard and listened to, but I think we've been concerned about life stage needs. They need to be with their own. And yes, there are times and appropriate times for that, but I think it's the whole body that needs to be together many times. I think our cultural influence, the idea that basically everywhere you look, the culture separates generations. And it just seems to be a logical and good thing to do. But Mary Pfeiffer, who's an American clinical psychologist, says, a great deal of America's social sickness comes from age segregation. If 10, 14-year-olds are grouped together, they will form a Lord of the Flies culture with its competitiveness and meanness. But if 10 people ages 2 to 80 are grouped together, they'll fall into a natural age hierarchy that nurtures and teaches them all. For our own mental and societal health, we need to reconnect the age groups. Not all the time.
It's a both and, not an either or.
It's a both and. And then one other piece is the church growth movement of the 70s and 80s. There were actually people saying, and I document a lot of this, there were people saying, really, most people are more comfortable with people their own age or in stage of life, and the best way to grow churches is to kind of form them around a certain age or stage. We were actually in a church in California in the early 2000s, and that church was a blend of a Church of Christ and a Christian church had gotten together. And we left, after 4 years, we moved away. We would go back and visit. Every year we go to Pepperdine, so we would go visit. And somewhere in the 2000s, they decided their demographic, they were following some of the ongoing church growth stuff, it was saying, pick a demographic that you're going to kind of aim at. So they picked 32-year-old young families with two children. And I thought, are you serious? Well, next year they're going to be 33. You going to drop them? What? I don't understand that. But they would kind of think, okay, what would that demographic like? What illustrations would work for them? What do we need to provide? I could not figure that one out. But that's what the church growth people were saying at the time. Some of you are looking like, what? And that's the way I felt. But that's what the church growth people were saying. I just think that's the oddest thing. I really thought, you know, next year they're going to be 33. You know, what in the world are you thinking? So those are some of the reasons why we separated the generations. There was some evidence that perhaps this might work best for church growth. We were concerned with cognitive development. We were concerned with life stage needs. Lots of things that were happening. So we had some reason for what we were doing. But of course, my question. By the way, I've written all this up if you're interested. It's Intergenerational Christian Formation. This came out in 2012. It is with InterVarsity Press, and it is a thick tome that addresses everything that we're talking about today. I'm just giving you the fun bits, but it goes into theory. I answer this question very, very thoroughly. Why should we bring the generations back together? I give lots of good support. Here's the premise of the book. Intergenerational Christian experiences especially and uniquely nurture spiritual growth and development across the ages. That's my premise. Took me a while to get there, but I believe, not just because I think so, but I've got some support for it, and I'll tell you. And I do believe that intergenerational faith communities are God-designed places for Christian formation. Again, not to say that Christian formation can't happen with just the six-year-olds together. Good things can happen there as well. But I do think this was a key piece of God's mind. You know, you do think of the Jewish community in the Old Testament. They were together. The feasts took place with everyone there so that when your children ask you, you will answer, well, if you're not there, you're not going to be able to answer. And if you're not with your children, you won't even know if they're asking. So the sense that when these feasts were called for by God, he knew that people would be together. This is a way of becoming who you are, knowing who you are, who God is, who you're called to be, what he's calling you to be, to see what he's done in the past, what he's doing in the future. And so we see those feasts as very interesting things, but actually a body of people, they were being formed in those. And we need opportunities like that for our children, our teens, and for all of us to be reminded of who we are, what God is calling us to be, and we live into that by being with other people on that same journey, at different places in the journey, of course. So that's a little bit of the why we should bring the generations back together. I do think it's biblical. I think it's theologically sound. But we did talk about all those reasons why we separated them. And so I think church leaders are very pressed to provide all these opportunities for all the age groups, and I think it's perfectly fine to do some of that. But how do you support the idea of saying we need to be together more often? And my one key answer is that spiritual development supersedes and undergirds all those other needs. That it's primarily a group and a cross-generational thing that needs to happen. And so you can support your desire for this, for intentional intergenerational community, by saying that spiritual development is not primarily cognitive development, it's not primarily psychosocial development, it's not necessarily related to ages and stages. My other area of expertise is children's spirituality. And we've been working for about 20 years. I'm part of a national organization that meets every 3 years. It's a conference on children's spirituality. We've been trying to work on a definition. It's hard to do. But we really do think that children are spiritual beings from birth, and that spirituality in children is not qualitatively different from spirituality in an 80-year-old or a 50-year-old. Now, they may express it differently. They're not going to... But it's like grief to say, oh, well, a 2-year-old isn't grieving when they lose their daddy. We wouldn't say that. We know they're grieving. They're not going to say, I know this is going to affect me all my life because losing a father figure is deeply impacting. They're not going to say that. But they're going to cry or be upset or not eat or something. We know they're grieving. They're missing that father. I think children experience spiritual things. They may not talk about it like we do, but it's not qualitatively different than God visiting you or you. When a child is present for a child, when God is present for a child, it is still God present for the child. It's not a different God or a different presence. So, if we are experiencing God at all the different levels, we can do so together. Not all the time, perhaps, but it is not qualitatively different. So that's part of what I would say about why bring the generations back together. The book outlines theological, biblical, theoretical, empirical, developmental, sociological, and practical support for the benefits and blessings of cross-age experiences. And we do have quite a bit of empirical work. I'm not going to share a lot of it, but a little bit. There are blessings for everybody when we're all together. Here are some of the blessings that show up in the literature as to why we need to bring the generations together, what blessings. A sense of belonging is one. I'll just tell you these. A sense of belonging is one that for everybody. Those of you who grew up in a small church of, say, 100 or 200, it was your church. They were your people. They knew you by name. Anybody could call you down. I mean, it was just, you belong there. You belong with them. They belong with you. It's harder to have that sense for a church of 1,000 or 2,000. But a church of 500, you can if the children are ever there. If they're never, I mean, literally in California, you dropped your children at one building and your teens at another building, and then you would get into the building and there would be a contemporary worship at 11 o'clock, but there would have been a traditional worship at like 9, and there would have been an emerging adult, although back then it was Gen Xers, at the night before. So you divided, that church, all those churches, they were big churches, they were divided into 5 generations. You never saw anybody from any other generation. So in literature, if you're never together, it's hard to experience this, the sense of belonging. Support for troubled families. Young adults raising little children is such a hard season of life. And most of your friends are also young adults raising small children. And you're just overwhelmed. You need some people a little further ahead to speak into your life, to encourage you to say you will not always be sleepless. There will come a time when you will get enough sleep. Years when you have a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, you just are run ragged. And then when they're 8 and 12 and 15, you're run ragged. You need someone, any of those early 20-somethings who have all the energy in the world, say, I'll stay with your kids. Or you need someone in their 40s or 50s who say, you know, it was kind of hard, but you know, you move on. You live through it. You will get through this. You've got to have those people in your life. You need people like that in your life. Who aren't in the same stage, who sit there and cry with you, I know it's terrible, I don't think I'm ever going to make it through. Well, you need someone not crying with you. Once in a while, you need somebody to cry with you. But young men, our 30-something men who feel such pressure to make it, to support their families, to be all things to all people at all times. And by the way, our young men, I see fabulously speaking into their children's lives so much better than some of the older generations did. But there's such pressure to make it in your field, and yet pressure to be a fabulous husband who does all this like February 14th stuff where you have to do amazing things instead of saying like, oh, it's February 14th, we'll order pizza. I mean, you know, that's one version. But today there's this pressure to have done something fabulous, you know, like make reservations 2 weeks ahead and all that. But they're trying to do that. They're trying to be super husbands, super daddies, super workers. They need men further ahead on the journey. Have the wisdom to speak into that. Help them choose priorities, not other men who are also just nearly dead on their feet. And they need some 20-somethings around them to do some fun stuff with. Just lay it all down, go play basketball once in a while. It's okay. Another advantage for the whole church when you do a lot of things intergenerationally is that you have better use of resources. You have those fabulous 20 and 30-somethings with great ideas, great energy, and then you have the wisdom and the money of age. These 20-something churches have no money and no wisdom. Oh, but they need some people who can support their ideas and love on them and encourage them. Bring that together, that's not a bad combination. You get some of that wisdom and some of those ideas, some of that energy and some of that money, you got some good things going. So we need each other. Character growth. Chad Hall says, when generations collide, the ensuing conflict reminds everyone that church is not about me. Who knew that church could be the cure for narcissism? You got to get along. You can't just, if you're the 20-something churches that we're part of right now, they can sing all the new songs they want. They don't ever have to sing anything like we sang this morning, by the way. I loved it. It's been months since I sang any of those songs. And the words were there. I couldn't even see the screen very well, but the words were there. It was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And I love somebody leading. I just love it. I went to Harding and was in the a cappella choir with Uncle Bud, and to me, someone leading and holding a note, I can do it. I was watching and I held the note as long as you did. I love that. I love that. And I miss it. But you know, if we have mixed congregations, you have to learn to kind of say, well, we need to sing some of those old songs because, you know, we need to give some honor here. And the older folks have to say, we're going to sing. I'm going to learn those songs. I'll learn them. But if it's just all the same, then you don't have to do that. You don't have to give in and give and take. So, cure for narcissism. But the most important thing is the opportunities that we have to share each other's spiritual journeys. And I have to say, when I was a kid, it didn't occur to me that old people kept on going. I thought you just got grown up at 50 and you were the same till you died. And, well, I passed 50. I wasn't there yet. I passed 60 and I'm not there yet. There's more to grow. And I want the kids around me to know that. I want to participate in their journeys and I want them to participate in mine. And I speak into college students a lot. And I say that a lot. I'm still growing. I'm still changing. There's still a long ways for me to go. I saw that picture in the 1970s of that really old wrinkled person that says, God's not finished with me yet. And I thought, oh, poor thing. Well, he's not. And we need to be with each other and recognize how God is still doing that in our lives. My favorite part of this, and you'll look ahead here, there is actual empirical support in the literature of the benefits of cross-generational experiences spiritually for children, youth, emerging adults, young, middle, and older adults, and congregations. It's all in my book. If you're really interested in that kind of stuff, it's there, and I detail the kinds of studies and research that have been done that show the benefits. And I'd love to share some of that, but we don't have time today. I will share a little bit from these guys. You may know David Kinnaman, Kara Powell, Christian Smith. Kara Powell's the Sticky Faith gal. She did her research. She's the one who did the Sticky Faith. She did this. She's at Fuller, and she did a study, and I think it's over now, 500 graduating seniors who were active in their youth groups, and these were across America. I think several states were involved in this, and she followed them. Her preliminary research was just their first year of college. Where were they in their spiritual lives? But now she finished them through their junior year, and I think she published it at that. She'd published some preliminary things, but after 3 years, where were they? She was actually, she's a youth minister by trade before she was worked at Fuller. She was looking for that silver bullet. You know, I'm going to find the thing that makes a difference, and I'm going to tell all the youth ministers, do this, and it's going to make the difference. Of course, most of the rest of us going, there's not going to be a silver bullet. Well, she said, there's not a silver bullet. However, she found two things that correlated most highly with those who had remained faithful and had, she called it, scored highest on the faith maturity scale or something like that. The two were, see if you know what the connection. One is they had participated in congregational worship as youth, and the other was they had worked with children on a regular and ongoing basis throughout their time in their congregations growing up. They'd worked with younger children. What do those two things have in common? They're cross-generational. I was going, ding, 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 I knew that. I was so proud and so happy. Her book didn't come out till 2011, and we'd already sent our book to the press. So the last piece of that's not there, but the first piece is there. She had already found that those who had participated in congregational worship, and maybe this isn't true in your church, but in a lot of the bigger churches, the youth have their own worship service. I don't know. Maybe you don't know that or whatever. They literally don't ever worship with anybody but themselves. I know you're thinking, surely that's not true. It's true. So in the general evangelical world, it's very, very common, not just to go out for Friday night or Sunday night, but to literally have a different worship service. So she's saying, keep them with you. So if you were thinking about sending them out, don't do it. And I think it's also true for children. They also need to be there. I'm not definitely and completely opposed to children's church, especially if they just go out for the sermon. But they need to be there for the prayers, the giving, the reading of scripture, the worship, all that. I really would keep them there for the sermons as well. But it's a little bit hard to change that right now. But you could kind of move that way because of what else is going on. Another reason, David Kinnaman, he wrote You Lost Me. Now he has, I think it's called Unchristian. Is that the book that's out? No. I've forgotten the name of the new one. You Lost Me. That's it. Anyway, he's got another one out. But he's done a bunch of research over 15 years trying to see what's important for spiritual formation and why, especially why kids are leaving the church, why emerging adults are leaving the church. And he comes up with three things at the end of this book that he reiterates in his next one. And the three things are, the first one is cross-generational relationships are crucial. That's his first. He said, what have I learned in 15 years of research? Number one, cross-generational relationships are crucial. Now, if our kids are always somewhere else, how are those relationships ever going to happen? And my good friend, Jason Lanker, who taught with me at John Brown, did his dissertation on mentoring with youth. And one question was, when did you first meet the person who became your mentor? And it was 7 to 10 years before he did his research, which was they were 18 and 19 and 20 years old. 7 to 10 years before that would be 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. They need to have adults. And Sunday school teachers are good, but they need to have ongoing relationships with people in their lives. And if they're never with anyone else, it's hard for that to happen. So these are all supporting ideas, do you see, for why we need to bring the generations back together and what are the benefits, what are the blessings. Christian Smith, I notice his books are downstairs. Soul Searching and Souls in Transition. These are heavy research books, but the most fabulous books I have ever seen on this subject. He followed 13 to 17-year-olds he just finished his research. They were 29 when he finished. So he's followed these same people from the time they were 13 to 29. This is a cross-section, 2,500 to 3,000 kids when he started. And he's looking at their spiritual lives. Now, he asked all kinds of questions. But he's saying, okay, what's going on spiritually and religiously in these 13 to 17-year-olds, which was the first book, 18 to 23 in the second book. His third book's not out, 24 to 29. It's not out yet. I'm just dying to see what he sees here is continuing. If you want to know what's really happening in emerging adults' lives, wow, that's where it's at. But, of course, for me, what was most important for what he said was, if nothing else, what the findings of this book clearly show is that, this is the first book, that for better or worse, these are the two crucial contexts of religious formation in the United States. Individual family households and multi-generational religious congregations. His words. He made that point, and he makes it in other ways, not just that one sentence. And this is this book. The empirical evidence tells us that it does, in fact, matter for emerging adult religious outcomes whether or not the participants have had non-parental adults in their religious congregation to whom they could turn for help and support. Adult engagement with, role modeling for, and formation of youth simply matters a great deal. Adult engagement with, adult role modeling for, adult formation of youth simply matters a great deal for how they turn out after they leave the teenage years. We've asked our youth ministers to do all that for all those kids. Can't be done. One youth minister, 50 kids, 30 kids, 20 kids. They need other adults in their lives that can play into that. And how can that happen if they're never with us? So they've got to be with us for these kinds of influences to happen. So that's my key point. Let's bring the generations back together. When we first wrote this book, we didn't think anybody would be interested. Huh, that didn't happen. I mean, nobody cared in the 2000s when I was doing my dissertation. But by 2010, 2011, big groundswell everywhere. Catholic churches, historically liturgical churches, evangelical churches, missional churches, emerging churches, charismatic churches. They're not really asking if they should do it. They're saying, how? Okay. Get past all that. We just want to know how to do it. That's always the question, always the question. But before I do that, I want to do one little thing here. This is the most important part of my book to me. No one else cares as much as I do. This is the theory underneath this. But do you remember my original question? Why do intergenerational settings? Why? The question was why. And I wanted there to be some reason besides God said so, because he doesn't exactly say so. He just demonstrates it in Scripture. But I thought, my background was educational psychology. I thought, what is it? Why is it that human beings would uniquely and especially grow in cross-generational settings? I thought there had to be an answer for that. There's only one book out on intergenerational stuff from the 1900s. It's 1988. And he says there's no theory under this. There should be, but there's not one yet. Nothing's been written about this. And three or four more books came out, but they didn't come up with a theory. So that was my goal, and I was going to be so embarrassed if there was nothing there. Oh, there's no answer. But there was. So, these are a bunch of theorists. You probably don't know. Some of you will. This is Piaget. This is Erickson, some of you will know. Bronfenbrenner, this is Westerhoff. He's a Christian educator. This is Albert Bandura, he's social learning theory. She's situative learning. This is my most important one. This is Vygotsky, this is Margaret Mead. I'm going to give you one sentence on each of these because this is so important. We think of developmental psychologists as talking about what three-year-olds can do and what seven-year-olds can do and what nine-year-olds can do. But actually, both Erickson and Piaget said, moving from stage to stage is best help with people further ahead of you on the journey. Seems pretty obvious, doesn't it? But we've ignored all that. I like Erickson's word. His word on this is, the generations benefit each other. That is, they grow each other up. There's a mutuality. And it wasn't just that these grow up, these people, we grow each other up. Didn't your children grow you up? They just do, because you're acting like a 22-year-old when you have them, and then pretty soon you're acting like a 16-year-old when you have them, and pretty soon you're starting to act like a 20-something. So we grow each other up. Love that. This is Erickson. So I found pieces in everybody's. Margaret Mead, she's the one who did all that stuff about the South Seas Island. She doesn't have a good name in Christian circles. However, her last book, 1978, she said, continuity of all cultures depends on the active presence of at least three generations. Continuity of all cultures depends on the active presence of at least three generations. Active presence. Now, she wasn't Christian. She wasn't talking about churches. But I think we can hear that. And Westerhoff, who is Christian, said, true community necessitates the presence and interaction of three generations. Presence and interaction. So it's there. There are little pieces everywhere. Bandura, really into social modeling or observing other people, that we don't actually have to learn everything the hard way. We can actually look ahead and say, that didn't work out well for them. Maybe I won't do that. So, and he's now looking at spiritual observation and modeling. We actually do learn. What is it like? What can it be like to live into this way of being? And you look around and you see what it looks like. You can throw things out if you don't like them, but we do observe. And people ahead of us do model. So he's starting to look at that. But until now, nobody really has addressed my question. But I found this fellow. He was Jewish, And I cannot find anywhere in the literature to make the connections. I'd like to, but he was Jewish. He was born in 1896. Oh, okay, I've got him showing here. Somebody do the math real quick, those of you who love to do that. Yeah, he was actually 37. It looks like 38, but he was 37. He died of, what's consumption? Tuberculosis? Yeah, he died of that when he was very young. He was in Russia, lived through the Russian Revolution, 1917, did all his writing in the 20s and early 30s, was influenced a little bit by Piaget, who was doing his early work, and Erickson, who were doing their early work. But he rejected both of them and said, actually, it's not behaviorist theory that explains why we learn, how we learn, nor is it just cognitive, the way our brains work. He said, it is our social, cultural context that influences how and what and why we learn. Can you connect the dots? I was like, this is it! This is it! It's not just sitting in class and learning something. It's who we're with and what we're doing and how we're doing it. And I just got terribly excited. Of course, nobody gets as excited as I do. But the way I talk about this is my potty training theory. Our oldest kid was he was terribly difficult to potty train. I bought the stickers, I bought the book, we did our thing. I mean, we slogged through that for months, and it was awful. When our second son came along, I thought, I don't even want to do this. I want to wake up, and he's going to be potty trained. Well, I walked into the laundry room, which was also a bathroom, carrying a load of clothes, kicked the door open, and there was David, the older one, had a little stool, demonstrating to his younger brother the skill of aiming straight. And you know what? Daniel was well on his way to proficiency. I was delighted. I hadn't done anything. I'd bought the book again. I'd lost my book and I bought another book. Got my stickers, got my M&Ms, but I hadn't done anything yet. It was happening. Now, if you've had kids, you know they tend to just kind of start picking up things, even things you don't really want them to pick up. Not just skills, but attitudes and ways of being, rules of the house that you haven't explicitly laid out. Don't bother mama on Saturday morning or whatever it is. You know, they pick up all this stuff from older siblings. And it's not because it was explicitly taught. This is what's going on. We learn, we pick up ways of being, attitudes, thoughts, skills, from those a little further ahead on the journey. And there's no better place to grow spiritually than in intergenerational settings where there's always someone, and they may not be older, who's a little ahead of you on the journey. I found my theory. It's Vygotsky's sociocultural theory. Nobody cares, but I do, because it answered my question. Of course, God knew this all along. He didn't have to wait for Vygotsky to find it, or for me to find it. But it answered my question, because I was going to be kind of embarrassed if I kind of did all this work and there was no answer. So it at least explains it to me. And for you now, if you want to read more about it, it's in the book. How? We'll spend the last few minutes on this. And before I start, if you have this fabulous thing that you're doing in your church that you just, it's so cool, it's so intergenerational, you love it, and blessed things are happening, give us a minute on it. Somebody, something wonderful that's happening in your church that's very intergenerational. I pick up all kinds of things in these settings. Okay, got two.
Yep. Well, this is short term.
Oh, you know, it's good.
We do mission trips.
You bet. Oh, and fabulous.
Last year, our age range was 14 to 70.
Love it. Write those things up. So that is probably the best thing to do, because you're doing it. You're living it. And you're not saying, we're going to learn how to do it. We're just doing it.
There's no TV, no media.
Which is what you say. Yeah. I love that. It's fabulous. Yeah. Bring even the little kids can go. I know you got to worry about that, but there's a story in the book. There's a story in the book about an 8-year-old who, what happened was, it wasn't just good for you, but that 8-year-old made friends with all the little kids, and they brought their parents. So it blessed the people there. So think about, yes, what were you going to say?
At least once a year, we bring our kids in the kids ministry together with our older members, and do what we call an energizer luncheon, and so the little kids with the older people.
Absolutely lovely. You have to really make that happen. It's just not going to naturally happen. I absolutely love it. Yeah.
We have family canoe and hiking.
Oh, great. Now you think, well, that's not spiritual. All a family canoe and hiking. That's not spiritual, but all of life is spiritual. All of life is spiritual. It simply is. Absolutely. You know, we used to keep the kids out for that. We'd have baptisms, and first baptism they ever saw was theirs. You know, not a good plan. Yeah, bring those kids in. Every opportunity you can think of, bring them in. Have them there. Yeah.
One of
that brings up something we do on baptism. As soon as we service is over, we all gather in a big circle. Everybody there holds hands and introduce them to their new family.
That's fabulous. These are ideas I've heard from people just like you in other settings. Real quick, I'm going to... Oh, these are. We have a chapter on each one of these. We have a chapter on all those. And lots and lots and lots and lots of stories. And I'm going to tell you four little quick things. I'm going up to New Hampshire next week or the next week, I forget, and to a church in New Hampshire. They brought everybody together and planted a garden behind their church building. They had the oldest people in the church who really knew everything about what you put in the holes and everything. And they brought all the young people who were like, I've never planted anything in my life. And they planted a garden, and they provide that food for the kitchens in town, the giving kitchens. Isn't that great? I mean, it's benevolent. They're learning together, learning a skill. So they do that. That's the Giving Garden in New Hampshire. A young African-American couple I met from St. Louis, he's youth pastor, had four. When I first met him, he had three little bitty kids. I mean, like one and two and three. And she was very pregnant with number four. And he says, I'm the youth minister. I cannot add another thing into my life. All my nights are gone. I said, you don't have to add anything. Whatever you're doing anyway, invite another generation to join you. Just pick a generation. He said, well, we're going roller skating. I said, well, don't invite the seniorest members of your church. But, you know, the 50s and the 60s, they used to roller skate a lot. They probably have some moves to show those. And open it up. Invite somebody. Now, think in terms of what you're doing and who you want to invite, but invite the second graders for something. Pick one little group of people. You don't have to have all the generations together for everything. Just pick another one. Northwest, there's a church there that has these fabulous 10 by 12 foot banners, floor to ceiling, and they have spiritual markers every year. Who was baptized, who died, who was born, lots of things that happened. And when I visited, there was a little kid about 12, and he was looking up there and says, that's when my sister was born. And he was pointing out some things. Isn't that a wonderful intergenerational activity? They make those banners every year. I don't know if they're still doing it. Silent Bible Church, a church in my town.
Nursing home.
Amazing gift. Wonderful thing to do. Oh, that is such an unreached place. We need to be doing that and nurturing that in our young people to see the needs of the older people there. And I've got two or three more examples, but I want to close with the most important thing we need to be doing with and for each other. And these can happen when we're hiking and canoeing and when we're doing all the other things that we're talking about, mission trips and stuff. And that is telling our stories. And we have, the last thing we'll do is the stories that I've given to people here. This was a story prompt. I've got several story prompts in here. You take a passage and then you say, how is that happening in my life? And the story prompt we're going to read is, this one. Let's see. This one. God, who delivered David from the bear and the lion and from Goliath, has delivered me from. And so I've been using this now for years, and these are the stories that I have gleaned. Who is the 7-year-old?
God, who delivered David from the bear and the lion and from Goliath, has delivered me from my nightmares. My small group prayed over me, and every night I remember Psalm 4:8. And God has kept me from waking up in fear.
And we know who that was. That's what he wrote. He dictated. Who has the 15-year-old? Read it loudly.
God has delivered me from the bear, the lion, and from Goliath. He has delivered me from an abusive home situation, and I am safe. And I am in a safe place, and God has made me safe.
Who has the 24-year-old?
God, who delivered David from the bear and the lion and from Goliath, has delivered me from hopelessness. I was trapped in a life of promiscuity, seeking from men what only God could give. As I have studied the Word of God in the lives of Rahab, Esther, Tamar, Ruth, Deborah, Lydia, and Mary, God has brought me to a place of hope and peace, a place I thought I could never be.
That was in a women's Bible study, and she wrote, we had been studying all those, and that's what she wrote. Who has the 40-year-old?
God, who delivered David from the bear and the lion and from Goliath, has delivered me from greed. I intended to make my first million by the time I was 30. I succeeded in that goal, but it brought me no joy until God delivered me from greed. As I've worked with our church's recovery ministry, God has replaced my greed with His spirit of compassion and generosity.
It was a sweet process to see. It was very good. And the 80-year-old.
God who delivered David from the bear and the lion and from Goliath has delivered me from my fear of death. I have been paralyzed for 2 decades by my fear of growing old and of dying. But in recent months, as I have comforted those in Blue Willow Hospice Care, God has replaced my fear with a place of contentment, a quiet calm, a joy in each day, and an acceptance that I will soon be with Him forever.
Fabulous stories and shared across the generations. I want to close with this sentence. No better place exists for the most number of people to learn Christian ways from more experienced members of the culture than in intentionally intergenerational Christian communities. However, for intergenerational Christian formation to happen, the generations must be together. They must know each other, and they must experience the body of Christ together. So I want to bless you to go out from here and just think intentionally. What else can we do? You don't have to change your whole church. Just what else can we do to bring 1 or 2 generations together, 3 or 4 generations together, or all 6? Blessings as you go. Thank you.